Changing the world in 140 characters. Is that Silicon Valley hyperbole or a description of the ultimate utilitarian tool? Well, the answer might explain how a company started by hackers, self-proclaimed anarchists, and social misfits became one of the most anticipated IPOs in the history of Wall Street. In his new book, Hatching Twitter, A True Story of Money, Power, Friendship, and Betrayal, New York Times technology columnist and reporter Nick Bilton provides an intriguing look behind the scenes of the social media giant Twitter. The book, which is published by Portfolio Penguin, is at turns a tech business primer, a thriller, and a look into basic human qualities like friendship, greed, and jealousy. And I'm very pleased to welcome Nick Bilton to our show. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
I've heard your book described as more like espionage than a corporate history. Did that occur to you while you were writing it?
Well, I think that the stories of the Valley are really fascinating. And when I set out to write this, I actually did a lot of research in how murder mysteries are written because, you know, we are told as reporters that there are these stories that take place. In the Valley, we call them creation myths. It's the creation of how a company was started. And
few of them as torturous and complicated as this one.
Well, this one was, way more than I expected. But these creation myths come out of the founders wanting to tell a story about a startup that was started on the back of a napkin and then became a billion-dollar company. And as I started to report and unfold this, it turned out that it was much more drastic than that.
Well, although it explores the Twitter phenomenon and its effect on a global scale on the future of how we communicate, report news, and share information, this is really a classic story of friendship, jealousy, mistrust, and greed. Should we be surprised? Didn't something similar happen with some other successful startups, especially Facebook?
You know, it's funny you say that because I was surprised. And I think maybe that's the idealistic, reporter in me that thinks that there are good people in the world. And I'm sure there are somewhere. I just haven't found them yet. But
There
are. Thank you. I take it you're one of them.
I'd like to believe I'm one of them. I can't speak for others.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because I think that there were good people in this story. You know, Noah Glass, who's the forgotten founder, he was an incredibly sweet guy, and I spent a lot of time with him. And He was the first one fired, and he never returned. And he was a very sweet individual. I think that the thing that I found really fascinating was that, some of these people are really cutthroat. One of the things that's really interesting is someone who read this story who's not in tech said, I'm sure this happens with every business. You have every business that is people are buying for control and pushing each other out left, right, and center.
To some degree, there are also stable places where everybody recognizes that the person in charge is doing a good job.
But with that being said, I think the question that I came out of reporting and writing this book saying is the chaos, I think, led to what this thing is. And it's actually – so the chaos was a good thing, although it may have come at the expense of some of the people involved.
Well, we have these four characters, Ev Williams, Jack Dorsey, Chris Biz Stone, that's the name he's given himself, and Noah Glass, each with similar backgrounds but distinctly different personalities. Can you give us a little introduction to each of them?
Absolutely. So Noah Glass is a very sweet guy. He kind of reminds me of Kramer from the Seinfeld.
Jack, from the Glass family, any relation to
I don't think
Ira
from,
or Philip?
I don't think so, but I'll double check.
Maybe the Salinger Glass family?
And then you have Jack Dorsey, who was a very, very low level engineer. He had a speech impediment as a child, who ended up rising up the ranks and kind of taking over until he was pushed out of the company, just like Noah Glass was. You have Ev Williams, who is comes from a tiny little town in Clarks, Nebraska, population 362 people, and moved out to San Francisco with the hopes of essentially changing the world a little bit with technology and computers, and invented a program called Blogger, and actually came up with that word blog. Blogger. And then you have Biz Stone, who was a total goofball, a really sweet guy. He's a jokester all the time, always has been. And he played the role at Twitter of being the guy who gave it its moral fence and gave it its personality.
Well, none of them came from money. In fact, they were all quite poor originally. How did they meet? Because they were poor, or is it just some other circumstance?
Well, that was really fascinating too. None of them came from money. They all come from, with the exception of Jack, from divorced homes and so on. Biz Stone, he grew up on, as he says, welfare cheese. And they all met in very interesting and unique ways. You know, Ev and Noah met because they were neighbors, and their apartments butted up against each other. Jack and Ev met because Jack was sitting in a coffee shop called Cafe Centro and recognized Ev when he walked in and emailed him to get a job. And so the way these things all came about was really a fascinating part of the story.
And their various personalities helped to shape what Twitter became, because it's different things to different people.
Yeah, I mean, what is it to you? Is it a media thing? What, you know, that's the big question, right?
Well, to me, it's something my staff takes care of.
You don't tweet?
Oh, sure. All of those tweets are from me. Absolutely. Anyway, how did they even come up with the idea of the 140 character?
So they came up with the idea. It wasn't 140 characters to start out with. It was actually unlimited. But the idea was that you would update your status and say what you were doing at that very moment in time. And that was that led to this idea of Twitter. Jack Dorsey had this concept that you would be able to talk about what you were doing. Evan Williams had a concept that you'd be able to hear what other people were doing. And those two things led to what it was.
And it still does both of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's still, you know, I think Twitter is essentially what you want it to be. Some people use it for conversations. Some people use it to share photos. Some people use it to see what other people are doing, and I think that's essentially what it's become.
Well, but to some degree, isn't that what Ev Williams was also looking into when he created Blogger?
Yeah, so Evan Williams, when he created Blogger, his goal was to create something that would allow people to have a voice, everyone to have an equal voice. And
then people would have to read it.
And the people would have to read it. But the idea was that you didn't need to own a printing press or a radio station to be able to have a voice out there.
And then he sold it to Google.
He sold it to Google for about $30 million. And he used that money, $20, $30 million, he used that money eventually to start Odeo, which was a company that led to Twitter. And Odeo's original idea was to disrupt radio, to change what radio was.
It was a podcasting company.
It was a podcasting
but
company.
But first, getting back to Blogger, has it thrived under Google?
It's still there. You know, I don't think Google understands social very well, but Blogger is still definitely there, yeah.
Because so often when these things are sold to a larger company, they kind of dwindle and fall apart because they really represent a culture that the bigger company would like to participate in, partake of, but doesn't really understand.
That's completely true. I think that, you know, you see this happen time and time again. I mean, MySpace was purchased and they disappeared. But there are times that that it doesn't happen. I mean, one example is Dodgeball was a competitor to Twitter in the early days, and it was purchased by Google and shut down, and the founder of that ended up creating Foursquare. And so, yeah, you see these things that are purchased and go away quite quickly.
Well, why did Odeo fail?
Odeo failed because of Apple. you know, Odeo started as this thing to bring podcasting to the masses, and there was a lot of chaos within the company. You had these very interesting characters that were former hackers and people that were against the man, as they say. One afternoon in 2005, Apple announced that it was going to quote unquote bring podcasting to the masses, and in doing so, essentially made Odeo non-existent in an afternoon.
My guest is Nick Bilton, who is a columnist and reporter for the New York Times and has written "Hatching Twitter: The True Story of Money, Power, Friendship, and Betrayal." It is published by Portfolio Penguin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So, how does podcasting company that fails lead to Twitter?
So they had these hack days where they organized people to come on and bring ideas with them and present them to the company. And some of the ideas were about, you know, replacing media with text messaging, building new audio-like voicemail systems, or all these different things. But one night, Noah Glass, who is you know, was running Odeo, he was going through a terrible divorce and he was incredibly lonely. And he sat there in a car with Jack Dorsey. It's around 2 a.m. They were drunk, February 26, 2006. And Jack brings up this status idea again of being able to update your status. And Noah's like, it's not that interesting. But what if you could use it to feel less alone? Like, what if you could connect with your friends? And that was the aha moment.
Now, Jack Dorsey is somebody we haven't really talked about. How did he come into the picture?
Jack came into the picture. He was sitting at Cafe Centro one afternoon, and Evan Williams walked in to order a coffee. He recognized Evan, sent him an email asking for a job, and ended up at ODEO. And from there, he essentially worked his way up. He was just a very low-level engineer, but he had a lot of drive. He really wanted to build something that was going to put his name on the map.
And you say that originally it wasn't limited to 140 characters. Isn't the fact that it is the simplicity what caught so many people's imaginations?
Absolutely. And it's funny, it was first unlimited, and then it became 160 characters, and then they knocked it down to 140. But it has a two-prong approach to it. The 140 characters is what helps people limit what they're going to say, but it also makes it very difficult for people to understand what it is.
Who came up with the name Twitter?
That was Noah Glass. So
and Tweet as well?
I think the users came up with Tweet, but Noah Glass was trying to come up with a name, and he was flicking through the dictionary, and his phone vibrated on the table, and he looked at the dictionaries and looked at the word vibrate, which led him to the word twitch, which led him to the word Twitter, and he knew instantly that's what it was going to be.
And he was probably the most enthusiastic about Twitter, an early proselytizer, but then he alienated both Ev and Jack. What did he do? If you say he's a very sweet guy.
He was erratic at the time. He was, he was going through a lot of changes with his divorce. His friendships were falling apart because they were tied into ODEO, and he just didn't have much of a choice but to kind of lose it a little bit. And he was staying up all night and building things in the office and not getting the proper work done. And I think that they just kind of got a little bit fed up.
And they fired him. Didn't he have sweat equity in the company?
Well, he had equity in ODEO. Ev eventually bought Noah out of that equity. But he didn't get equity in Twitter until much later.
And then Jack Dorsey was fired not long after.
Yeah, I think everyone was fired at one point or another. Jack was fired in 2008 because he was just not doing a very good job running the company. And so after several trials and efforts, they said, you got to go. And then Ev took over. And then Jack spent as the book shows, a couple of years coming after Ev until he got Ev fired. And now Dick Costolo, who was not even a founder, runs the company.
But this, to some degree, sounds like the story of Steve Jobs.
Oh, yeah,
at
absolutely.
Apple.
Yeah, I mean, Jobs was fired in 1984 and then returned. Built the company into what it is today.
And Jack Dorsey is back at Twitter, isn't he?
Well, he's his executive chairman. He's not there in a day-to-day role.
So is he the last man standing?
Well, Ev is still the largest shareholder. He owns 10.4% of the company.
Well, because he put the most money in.
So him and Jack are still there.
How did Ev's vision of Twitter and Jack's vision of Twitter reflect their own personalities?
I think that, Ev was always about sharing information about other people, and Jack was always about sharing information about himself, and I think Twitter became both of those things.
But Jack is the one who claimed to be the inventor.
Jack claimed to be the inventor, and I think Ev saw it as an iteration. There's a moment in the book where Jack says, I invented Twitter, and Ev says, you didn't invent Twitter. No one invented Twitter. The same reason I didn't invent blogging, we just iterated on something that already existed, and that was forums.
And he says they simply expand on an idea that already exists.
Correct, yeah.
So do you think that's pretty accurate?
Yeah, I mean, who invented radio? It was an iteration on a telephone. You invented the telephone. It was an iteration on the telegram, and I think that that's relevant for everything.
How did that tension between Jack and Ev and the tension that exists as to what Twitter really is, here's what I'm doing now, or here's what's going on around me, actually provide much of the tool's power?
What do you mean? How did it?
Well, because there really are, as you pointed out earlier, there really are two different competing visions here. And people fought for one or the other. When did they realize, wait a minute, what's really good about this is that people can use it either way?
I don't think they have realized that yet. I think they're still struggling to figure out what Twitter is. And, I think the company, some people see it as a communication tool, some see it as a media tool, some see it as a way to talk about themselves. And I think that's what makes Twitter Twitter, right? It's, Noah Glass once said, Twitter is whatever you want it to be.
What is he doing now?
Well, Noah's still recovering. I mean, he was, betrayed by his friends. They became billionaires. He didn't. And he's exploring new ideas.
Among the anecdotes from the book that's been receiving a lot of attention is a meeting in 2009 between Al Gore, his current TV co-founder Joel Hyatt, and Twitter's Ev Williams and Biz Stone. And you report that with copious amounts of wine and Patron tequila fueling the conversation, Gore made a pitch to buy Twitter.
That is correct. They he invited them up for dinner at his place and got them drunk and made dinner for them and then tried to pitch it. But Biz Stone, said that he didn't think that it would be right to go and sell to Al Gore and Current TV when there were all these other TV places out there.
And he's the one who told you that?
Well, I interviewed all of the founders for the book.
And how open were they?
In the beginning, not at all. But as I gathered documents and information, they became much more open.
Well, you're from the New York Times. They must have been a little afraid that
suddenly
all of the dirty linen was going to be aired in America's most important newspaper.
Yeah, pretty much.
Nick Bilton is a columnist and reporter for the New York Times. He's written a book called Hatching Twitter, A True Story of Money, Power, Friendship, and Betrayal. It's published by Portfolio Penguin. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Nick Bilton, who's a columnist and reporter for the New York Times, also leads its popular Bits blog, where he explores the disruptive aspects of technology on business and culture, the future of technology, privacy, and the social impact of the web. He has written a book called Hatching Twitter, A True Story of Money, Power, Friendship, and Betrayal. It's published by Portfolio Penguin. And we have a listener who has written in. I don't know whether it's on Twitter or Facebook or on our show page. She called. Oops, old-fashioned technology. She said, only using a few characters. Well, Louis Menand of The New Yorker had the idea to use only 50 words for the cat in the hat. So has Twitter inspired other people to start thinking along those lines?
There's been some Twitter book clubs where you have to write a book in 6 words. There has been, there are short movies that people share on there and other things like that.
Of course, Hemingway did a story idea in just 8 words.
Do you remember what it was?
I can't remember, but it was very effective.
Yeah, it was great.
Can you speak to the evolution of Twitter and how it took turns that no one could have predicted?
Well, there's a great scene in the book where there's a moment at the South by Southwest award show, and Twitter in 2007. The folks at Twitter are watching as people use it to find which bars to go to. And so they're sitting in a bar and they'll see someone tweet, there's a party over here, and everyone runs over. And then later in 2009, it was used in the same exact way in the revolution in Iran.
Well, did it take off immediately?
No, it took years to take off.
And it played a role in Tehran also, later in Cairo, in the overthrow of Mubarak.
Yeah, and that's, that was where I think it really had its debut on the main stage of the world, because the people were using it to essentially overthrow a dictatorship, and it's been used in countries all over the Middle East since then.
So who was reading those tweets? The people involved in the movement, or were people at your newspaper reading them to find out what was going on?
It was actually the State Department was the ones that found it. There's a chapter in the book about this, about how the State Department gets access to some of these tweets and realizes that there are these revolutions taking place because they don't have news crews on the ground, and that's how they discovered it.
On the other hand, some people have said that its importance has been overstated.
What Twitter's?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how you can say that. I think, Twitter's a company that's changed everything. It's changed the way we perform media, religion, business, and it's still going to continue to do that. You have astronauts in space that are tweeting. You have the Pope that's tweeting. You have presidents of Iran, of America, of countries all over the world that are using this service.
But we also have people who are telling us what they're having for dinner, and I've always wondered why anyone would care.
But that's the beauty of Twitter. They care, and you may not, so you don't have to follow them, right? And I think that's one of the things I try to get at in the core of the book, is that it means something different to everyone. And if you want to follow what Justin Bieber just had for lunch, you can do that. And if you want to follow the Pope, you can do that.
Does the Pope tell us what he had for lunch?
I don't think he does, but he tells us what we should be doing in our lives that is good and whole.
One of the threads that runs through the book is loneliness. You've been talking about it in the term in Noah Glass's life, and how Twitter saw it as a way to help people form communities and connect with each other. What role does the need for personal interaction help in Twitter's development?
Well, this is the lesson that Noah Glass has to learn throughout the book, is that he originally sets out thinking that this thing he built will connect him to other people and make him feel less alone. And it ends up making him feel more alone than ever, because you can't find those connections with technology. You can make better connections with people that you already know and you care about, but you can't build new, you know, human connections. I think those can only really happen in human form.
Well, isn't there some irony in the fact that social media tools like Facebook and Twitter were developed by people who are, in many cases, somewhat lacking in communication skills themselves?
Well, that's the case. That's the story, right? You know, every single one of these founders had some sort of issue with the way that they looked at technology as a way to be able to communicate with the world from their bedroom. And some of them learn along the way that you can't do that. And I think that we live in an age where everyone out there, you know, the people are probably listening to this on their iPhones and their iPods and their iPads and their computers, and they're constantly pecking at these screens, looking for something. And what I think some of the people in the book find is that that thing is the human who is right in front of you.
Well, as you point out, one of the founders had a speech impediment.
Correct.
So this is a way of being able to speak.
Yeah, I think they all went through that. They all had this thing where, and I recognize this. I grew up with computers, and I completely understand it. And I saw that immediately with the reporting of the book. They all had this thing where they looked at technology as a way to connect to people. And I think that, you know, for me, the thesis of this book, while it's about a company that changed everything, it's about these four friends who built something that they thought would connect them to each other and ended up tearing their friendships apart.
Well, I can't tell you how many books have come into our show, and we also get a lot of magazine articles that say technology is ruining communication.
I agree. I completely agree. I mean, it's fascinating. You know, I'm doing this book tour, and the media machine that exists because of technology is just mind-blowing. You have, especially here in New York, you know, you have radio stations, you have magazines, newspapers, all these things, but they are all flowing through these devices. And at what point is enough enough? I think that's the question. And that's the question that, although this is a company about a book, a book about a company and about a technology, it's much more than that. It's about the way we look at devices and things like Twitter and Facebook and social media and how that connects us to people or takes us away from them.
And then devices have to be developed to handle this.
Correct. Yeah.
So smartphones and have to be able to handle tweets I guess they wind up just there's this vicious cycle that develops, because one thing just leads to another, which leads to another, which leads to another.
Yeah, it's not stopping. You know, people always ask me, you know, what's the next big technology in the Valley, and I would say it's wearable computing. So you know, Google Glass is the beginning of that, where you wear glasses over your face. It's a very, very early stage of it.
And horrifies a lot of people.
And horrifies me, as I've written about before. But one of the things that will flow into that are tweets and other social media things like that. And I think that it's really fascinating when you kind of look at the genesis of these companies and where they will be in the future as far as what we consume and share and so on.
People have been writing in. Okay. In response to our conversation, Mott and Red Hook tells us that the Hemingway sentence was, "For sale, baby shoes never worn.
Yep, that's right.
But another listener wonders, how has Twitter and the rest of Silicon Valley responded to NSA surveillance programs? Are the programs hurting their bottom lines?
Well, the rest of Silicon Valley is kind of in shock by it. I think some people knew what was going on, but some people had no idea. But Twitter, you know, and these are the stories in the book, it was a company that always fought for the user. It always put privacy first. And Biz Stone, I think the big role he plays in the story is that he was always adamant about privacy and users. And also this gentleman, Jason Goldman, who is like the fifth unnamed founder.
Because they were radicals to some degree? There's an anarchist in the mix?
Well, with Biz, it's because he didn't care about money. You know, the introduction to the chapter on Bits was he was sitting in his office in Google where he'd worked for a while, and he was going to quit to go to Odeo, and his boss said, "Do you not care about money?" And he said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you're going to give up $2 million by leaving." And he said, "Well, I don't care about money." And I think that that's one of the things that made him be such a good guy within the company.
Last month, an activist live tweeted a phone conversation with Michael Hayden, the former head of the CIA-NSA, that he was having with a reporter on a train.
Yes.
And that became a big news story.
Yeah. Well, that's an example of what Evan Williams set out to do. He wanted to change the way people communicate and share things. And in the past, you would have had to have called up a reporter at the New York Times or a radio station to be able to say that. But this guy pulled out his phone and tweeted the whole thing.
Now, for all of the new companies, the big issue is, how do they make money? How does Twitter make money?
So Twitter makes money through sponsored advertising, through sponsored tweets, and a variety of other things. They will eventually make money by through transactions within tweets. So if you were to tweet a link to my book and say, you know, Nick Bilton's coming on to the radio, people would be able to buy it from directly within there.
But Twitter, according to articles in The Times and The Wall Street Journal, continues to have problems figuring out how to make money from users abroad.
Yeah, so a lot
of... it's still not a moneymaker.
Well, they're going to make $600 million this year. Next year, it'll be over $1 billion. And it's not profitable, but the reason it's not profitable is because it's expanding, and where they're trying to expand is globally.
But how long before they can become really profitable?
I think they could become profitable today if they wanted, but they would just have to stop hiring new people and acquiring other companies. But they've chosen to take the long haul.
Well, there is that other problem that something comes along, it becomes the big sensation, and then a couple of years later, it's replaced by something else. And
well, that's exactly the case.
And I'm sure that's something that they fear right now.
Well, they don't seem to, well, I think they worry about Facebook. But it's interesting because I interviewed, you know, all of the founders for this book extensively, and they all said that they believed that Twitter would be around for 50 years, for 40 years, except for Noah Glass, who said eventually something else will come along. And it seems that he seems to have the most realized view of what this would be.
A listener, Shirley from Montclair, says that the true connections are made through Twitter. She's been using Twitter for years, and has connected over issues like disability, professional pursuits, etc.
Yeah, they absolutely do connect. You know, I've met many people on Twitter that have become friends of mine. But the point that I think that I make in the book is, you know, when you take Noah Glass, here he is at this moment in this car. He's going through a divorce. He's losing his friends. And all he wants is to be connected with these people, and he thinks this technology will do that. And if they're not there in the first place, the technology is not going to solve that problem. So, yes, it can connect you to people, but you also need that human connection.
But Facebook already uses the word friends.
Facebook does use the word friends, and Twitter does not. But I think that the difference is – I mean, do you use Facebook at all? Yeah. So I use Facebook, but I don't. It doesn't feel like it has the impact. I mean, it's changed the way we communicate. Twitter's changed everything, and so Facebook feels more like an address book to me.
But both of these things are generally the province of younger people.
Correct.
Although, well, there are older people who are doing both.
There's a study that just came out last week from the Pew Research that said that teens are abandoning Facebook in lieu of Instagram and Twitter. And the reason is because they feel more open on those services.
But Instagram is owned by Facebook.
Instagram is owned by Facebook, which was a very smart move by Mark Zuckerberg to purchase that company.
Well, the story of Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg was a film, the Social Network, a very successful film. I'm assuming that people are approaching you about making this into a film.
There has been a lot of interest from Hollywood about this book and it becoming a movie. There's, you know, some people have talked about the idea of making it a Netflix TV show or, you know, HBO or something like that. And I think that, you know, this is not just another Social Network 2.0. You know, this is a story about four guys who were flawed individuals, unlike Mark Zuckerberg, who seems like he was like a robot someone built in a lab somewhere. But the founders of Twitter are these four individuals that accidentally changed the world and changed themselves too.
Can you do that without their cooperation, make a movie? And I know there were lawsuits in connection with the social network.
Well, there were lawsuits in connection with the social network for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons was because there were people that were not put in the story that were upset that they weren't. So they were suing because they said that it wasn't a true account. And as for making a movie about these guys, the rules are if they're already out there in the public sphere, and they are very much so because they all became celebrities, then you can make a movie.
Is it just a coincidence that today is the pub date for this book, and tomorrow we'll see the pricing of Twitter stock? On Thursday, the company will go public.
It is partially coincidence. I can't say that I actually picked the day knowing it would be the day before, but I was pretty admunt about November 5th. My publisher and I were just talking about this morning because I had an idea that it was going to be within this the next couple of weeks. But I mean, I think I literally could not have timed it better if I tried.
Regarding the company's upcoming IPO, what has Twitter learned from Facebook's experience, which turned out to be a disaster at first?
Well, Twitter's learned a lot. Twitter's pricing the company much lower than they probably could.
But it's still in the billions.
It's still in the billions, yeah. Well, that's all we deal with out there in Silicon Valley these days is billions. It's still in the billions, but, you know, it's going to go out at around, you know, 11 to 13 billion, whatever, you know, in that price range. A lot of people thought it would go 16 to 20 billion. And what happened with Facebook was it was a company that was – everyone said it's worth $50 billion, but they went out at $100 billion at the IPO, and the stock fell to $50 billion. Now it's up. And I think Twitter has learned that lesson, and instead of going forward, they've lowered the price. And I'm very confident that it will do very, very well.
Nick Bilton is a columnist and reporter for The New York Times, been writing from Silicon Valley. And the book we've been discussing is Hatching Twitter, A True Story of Money, Power, Friendship, and Betrayal. It is published by Portfolio Penguin. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.